You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Sidney Powell, the author of Licensed to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice. Sidney, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Dave. It's my honor.
Is it okay if I call you Sidney, or would you prefer Ms. Powell?
Oh, you please do, yes.
Okay. I kind of feel like I know you after reading this book, or at least know something about you.
You do.
Yeah.
Yes.
I do. And thank you for writing this book, because I learned so much, and it's such an important book for anyone who's concerned with the history of the judiciary in the United States and concerned with the direction that it's going and concerned with the problems that we are facing now. And of course, we're going to get into all that in great detail in a moment. And of course, more about the wonderful book, Licensed to Lie. But before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Yes, I was a federal prosecutor for about 10 years in three different districts across the country, the Western District of Texas, the Northern District of Texas, and the Eastern District of Virginia for a brief period of time. I worked under 9 different United States attorneys from both political parties. And throughout my career in the Department of Justice, the U.S. attorneys always told me to do what was right and to do it the right way. I never felt any sort of political pressure or internal pressure in the office to achieve any particular result, but simply to follow the law and to treat people fairly. And that's the way all the assistant U.S. attorneys I knew and worked with proceeded. We're talking a number of years ago now that I was in the department. For the last 20 years, I've been in private practice doing federal appeals and complex commercial litigation, primarily on the civil side. I've been editor of the Fifth Circuit Reporter, which is the court I practice in primarily, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. I've done over 500 federal appeals, 350 of them for the government, and about 150 in private practice. I'm past president of the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. I'm past president of the Bar Association of the Fifth Federal Circuit. I taught approximately 3 weeks a year for a number of years in the Attorney General's Advocacy Institute for the Department of Justice. And I've taught and chaired the annual Fifth Circuit Seminar for approximately 20 years. I've taught with federal judges all over the country on any number of different topics and in various seminars and for bar associations also.
Wow, that's a lot. And for somebody with your background to come out and reveal what you revealed, it's groundbreaking. It's incredibly significant. Of course, what I'm saying now to you, the listeners, if they haven't read the book, they really would have no idea what I'm talking about and what you're about to get into. That's why it's so important for folks to pick this book up, because I can't emphasize it more. If you care about the country, if you care about the direction that the country is going in, you have to get this book. It does read like a thriller, even though it's factual. Who's that well-known author who writes the legal thrillers?
Are you thinking about John Grisham?
Yeah, Grisham, right. I mean, why read a John Grisham novel because it's fake when you can read something real like this and learn about the legal system from somebody who's been in it for as long as you have? That's what I don't understand, why people would want to read a fiction book versus a nonfiction. This stuff really happened, and that's a scary part of it. On page 391, and I know I'm jumping around a bit here, and that's toward the end of the book, but you say here that you had wanted to be a part of the justice system or the legal system since you were 5 years old.
Yes.
How did you know?
I really didn't, but my mother reminded me that I would literally come home from kindergarten and sit down in the afternoons and watch Perry Mason. And of course, since then, I've found better reasons to be a lawyer, but I literally, I'm sure, have seen every Perry Mason show at least 20 times.
Wow, that's great. That brings back memories, Perry. I don't even know if it's on TV anymore. I don't watch TV, but it probably isn't, right? Those are the old black and white shows, right?
Yes, and then, of course, they had a new series much later, too, and I watched all those as well, just, you know, on general principles.
Mm-hmm. On page 50, you mentioned this as well, that you have represented the United States in 350 criminal cases. I know from reading your book and being educated now from reading it, that you explain that the government, at least when you were in the department, that they would not go after someone unless it was pretty much an ironclad case. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, our theory was that there was more than enough crime out there to prosecute. We certainly didn't need to go making up anything or pushing the envelope to prove a point. The districts I worked in, for the most part, in Texas had major, major drug cases. In fact, I tried one of the first continuing criminal enterprise prosecutions in the country against a drug dealer who'd actually had a federal judge assassinated. So, I mean, we were doing extremely high profile and big drug cases. And of course, bank robberies and things that the public generally knows are federal crimes, the kind of crimes you see on a lot of the TV shows. So we had more than we could shake a stick at dealing with all the crime that there was, and still is, for that matter.
Your book concentrates on a couple of main factors, and please correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm certainly not an attorney, and this is relatively new to me, these topics that you discuss. But I think the main part of the book here is something called Brady material. Is that right?
Yes, there's a constitutional doctrine named after a famous Supreme Court case called Brady versus Maryland. And that case says that the Constitution requires federal prosecutors who hold all the cards in a criminal prosecution to provide to a defendant any evidence that is favorable to his defense, whether it be in mitigation of the punishment that he might face, or goes to whether he actually committed the crime or not, or would affect his sentencing in any way. So that is a very important fundamental doctrine to a fair trial. It's an absolute imperative for the government to produce that evidence. And what I found in the last 10 years, as I represented one of the Merrill Lynch executives in the Enron litigation, was that the Enron Task Force prosecutors had failed utterly in their obligation to produce Brady material and engaged in numerous other high-handed and terrorist tactics to prosecute the people that they believed or intended to prosecute as a result of the collapse of Enron. And that spilled over to also Department of Justice practices in indicting and prosecuting former United States Senator Ted Stevens, the longest-serving senator from the state of Alaska. And in that case, the prosecutors intentionally and systematically withheld evidence that was favorable to his defense. It took us a number of years, but we later found out that they'd done the same thing in the Merrill Lynch Enron case. And I found that behavior so appalling and so dishonest and corrupt that I absolutely had to write the book when the system failed to rectify that. I just couldn't stand it. I mean, this is not a book I ever wanted to write. It broke my heart to have to write it, but I had to because I couldn't stand letting this kind of conduct go uncorrected and unknown.
I guess here's the whole scary part of this. And again, as I've learned from reading your wonderful book, the prosecutors have basically all the cards, and they get all the evidence, they go to the crime scenes, they decide what the defense can see, what the defense can hear. They basically can make or break the defense's case, all based upon whether or not they divulge this exculpatory evidence. And so my question is, Sydney, how can we be certain that any trials are untainted?
It's very hard to have that level of certainty. Fortunately, most criminal convictions are valid. There is not Brady material in every case. Some cases are pretty much slam dunk. We know exactly who did it, and you know there's plenty of evidence and plenty of witnesses. But I would say that in approximately 20% of federal prosecutions, particularly now, and also the state prosecutions for that matter, there is a significant doubt as to whether the person did what they're accused of doing or played the particular role that they might be accused of having played to the degree the prosecution thinks they played it. And we've got to do a better job of making sure that all of the evidence is presented to the jury. Judges can do a lot to stop this. That's another thing Judge Kaczynski noted in his dissent in the Olson case. Judges must put a stop to this. One of the things I've suggested as I've spoken to judges around the country is that they enter Brady compliance orders. I even drafted one and put it on the website for licensetolie.com, a draft Brady compliance order that requires the government to produce things on a particular schedule and with penalties if they fail to do so. We've also got to get bar associations to start stepping up to the plate and dismissing and suspending lawyers who violate Brady. Right now, hardly anyone is doing anything about it. And as my friend Bill Hodes, who also endorsed the book, said, one of the most insidious problems with Brady is that we don't know what we don't know.
Right.
A defense attorney simply doesn't know what he doesn't know. although instincts usually kick in pretty well when the government is being obstructionist about providing information. I mean, just look at the IRS email situation. I've written about that extensively at the New York Observer at observer.com. I have a number of articles there. And the fact that the harder they fight to hide something, the more likely you are to know that there's something good that you need to get that helps your defendant.
Right. When you're picking up flack, you're in the right area.
Right. Yes. Most good prosecutors, and most prosecutors are good, follow an open file policy and don't want to convict the wrong person. It's when main justice, as we call it, in D.C. gets involved for some reason. They seem to think a different standard applies to them. And then there's always the just overly zealous prosecutor out there who wraps himself in the flag and thinks he can do no wrong. Some of them think that, well, if the person didn't do this, they did something else. They're just bad people who need to be in prison. But that's not the way our system of justice is supposed to work. Each trial has to be evaluated on its own, the facts of each case on their own, in front of a fully informed and attentive jury. And until we have that, everyone is at risk of being prosecuted. That's another reason I had to write the book, because there but for the grace of God go any of us. And the Merrill Lynch defendants in particular spent a year in prison on an indictment that didn't even state the criminal offense. We couldn't get them bail pending appeal. They hadn't taken any money from anybody. Meanwhile, the prosecutors had actually yellow highlighted evidence that was favorable to the defense and hid it, deliberately hid it, for years while these men spent the year in prison and beyond. And the prosecutors became chief White House counsel, general counsel deputy director of the FBI, the acting attorney general for the criminal division, who unseated Senator Ted Stevens and micromanaged that corrupt prosecution. It's just an outrage. And they're all still practicing and flourishing, while the lives of four Merrill Lynch executives were ruined.
Right. And one of these people that you're alluding to may even become the new attorney general.
That's right. She's on the short list being discussed as a replacement for Eric Holder. Her name is Catherine Rumler, and she went back to an extremely lucrative law practice at the stellar firm of Latham & Watkins.
I have to say that besides the fact that the book was really amazing in the way that it caught my attention and read like a thriller, it got me angry many times because I guess for the same reasons that you got angry when you thought for sure whether it was Judge Werlein, did I say his name right?
Werlein, yes.
Whether it was Judge Werlein, whether it was the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, whether it was the Supreme Court, although the Supreme Court, somehow they saw through all the nonsense and they ruled properly when they took the cases. But when these justices and these courts, when they just literally ignored the law, this is what I don't get. For example, you talk about the Speedy Trial Act. That's the law, pure, plain, and simple. There's no way around it. They had gone past the time of the Speedy Trial Act, right? There's
yep.
No other way to interpret that.
I couldn't see one.
Right. Where you researched the Speedy Trial Act, you found out that. But besides the Speedy Trial Act, you talked about the yellow highlighting. These judges literally ignored and continue to ignore the law and serious violations of the law. How could they do that? Why do you think they just ignore the law?
Judge Werlein has been known for years to be nothing short of a shill for the government. I don't know what else to call him. The government knew he would be loath to rule in favor of the defense. He just gave the government basically everything they wanted. The only time we got any relief from him was at sentencing when, thank goodness, he realized that these guys had not taken any money from anybody, and even Enron had made $53 million on the transaction that they were being punished for having participated in, and he said they were literally just doing their jobs. But that didn't keep him from sending them to prison for a year. At least he didn't give them sentences of 25 years, which is what the prosecutors wanted. That's the only place we made any progress with Judge Werlein. He just simply refused to read and follow the law. And as you noted, he never, in his, I think he wrote a 63-page decision denying our motion for new trial after we found the yellow highlighted evidence that directly contradicted the government's case. He did not even mention the existence of the yellow highlighting. And most disappointing for me in particular was the fact that the Fifth Circuit never mentioned the yellow highlighting either. The court did find that the prosecutors had plainly suppressed evidence favorable to the defense. but they held it wasn't material or it didn't matter to the case, that there was so much other evidence supposedly that convicted my client in particular that it didn't matter that the prosecutors had yellow highlighted evidence that directly contradicted 16 statements they made to the jury in closing argument alone and more than 50 references to their key witnesses, which the yellow highlighted evidence undercut completely. In fact, to say it didn't matter, the Fifth Circuit had to imagine a case completely different than what the government tried, and that's not the way the law was supposed to work either.
There's something seriously wrong here, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
When do you think that it got to this point where it became so politicized? When do you think it did, and why do you think it did?
Well, there was enormous pressure in the collapse of Enron, enormous political pressure to make people pay for that financial debacle that hurt so many people nationwide. And obviously, you know, hundreds of thousands of people lost a lot of money, including their retirement savings and all of that. And there were things wrong at Enron. There were people that were stealing money. Fast Al Glisson and Fast Al's protege, Copper, were stealing millions. Fast Al in particular stole millions. But the government, when it went about its prosecution, cast its net far too wide and ensnared people that had not committed crimes. And they actually made up crimes to try to get people, which is just so counter to what we're supposed to do in this country. It's beyond offensive. Overly creative, overly zealous. When Michael Chertoff picked them, and this was under the Bush administration that the Enron Task Force formed, Michael Chertoff picked known terrors of prosecutors. I mean, they prided themselves on being terrors of prosecutors, which might have been an attitude needed to prosecute mob bosses in New York, where many of them cut their teeth. But it doesn't translate appropriately to businessmen who have tried to do the right thing all their lives and acted on advice of counsel, even in the Merrill Lynch Enron matter. They just went nuts.
They went nuts, but they violated, as you said on page 201, they violated the Constitution, they violated the Supreme Court, and they violated legal ethics. And they got promoted.
Right. They drew seven-figure salaries in multinational law firms, and they got promoted to the highest halls of our government.
Wow. It's not just here in the legal profession or the justice system that this obviously happens. It seems to be rampant now throughout the United States and in all industries that you screw up and you get a promotion. Do you think that there's a possibility that the DOJ had something on Werlein or has something on Werlein that he basically just ignores the law and just does whatever the government wants? I know he might be pro-government. Do you think they might have something on him? Is that a possibility?
I guess it's a remote possibility. That's not what I think. I mean, I think he's just extremely pro-government, and some judges are. I mean, judges should be selected for being open-minded and fair and not predisposed one way or another. But for some reason, he is just extremely pro-government. A lot of Fifth Circuit judges are now, too. They are just simply loath to reverse a criminal conviction. It's very difficult to get one reversed.
So they're not open-minded at all. Right. They're not open-minded at all.
Yeah. Not as much as they used to be. I mean, the Fifth Circuit literally used to be known as the court of legal giants. It's become very grudging in its protection of individual rights.
How many circuits are there, Sydney?
There are 13 or so, I think. First through 11, and then the Federal Circuit and the D.C. Circuit.
Okay. Well, you're talking about the prosecutors, their overzealousness and literally breaking the law. Here, you say on page 82 that one of these particular fellows, and we don't need to spoil the book for all the listeners who are going to pick it up, so I don't even want to get into even their first names, but let's just say Weissman. Weissman and his task force had pressured Merrill Lynch to stop paying the legal fees for the defense of the executives. Now, that sounds to me a little unethical. Is it? And how could he do something like that?
They could do that because as part of their non-prosecution agreement with Merrill Lynch, after they destroyed Arthur Andersen and put 85,000 people out of business, they extracted an extremely onerous non-prosecution agreement from Merrill. And pursuant to that, they even installed an overseer from the task force in Merrill Lynch for 18 or 24 months or so. And that person was even reviewing our legal bills. It was absolutely outrageous, but he was able to do that because, again, the government could have given Merrill the death penalty just like it did Arthur Andersen. Merrill was forced to agree to pretty much anything they wanted. Now, you're right, it was unethical and it was unconstitutional, and thank goodness the Second Circuit held that very thing in a case called Stein, S-T-E-I-N. So at some point, Merrill reimbursed the Merrill defendants for their legal fees that they had to pay out of pocket during that horrible year when the government insisted that Merrill stop paying them. Yeah, we have the Second Circuit in the Stein case to thank for solving that problem. The court there held that it was unconstitutional and in denial of the right to counsel, I believe, to force a company to stop paying the legal fees for its properly defended defendants.
Incredible, yeah. The low tactics that these people who are supposed to be representing the Constitution for fair justice, they should not be concerned about, as you explained in your book, they should not be concerned about how the case unfolds. They should be concerned with only seeking justice. And if they have evidence
right.
that shows that the defense has more of a case than they do, then fine. Who cares? Don't take a personal stake in it. Just do your job.
Right.
Look for justice. And I know that's why you, and that's why I say I feel like I know you, and I know that's why you did what you did, because you feel that way very strongly, that it's much bigger than whether you make seven figures or you move up to this prestigious law firm. It has to do with serving justice, right?
Yes, exactly right. And finding the truth. Getting as close to whatever the objective truth is that you possibly can. The task force didn't understand a lot of these business transactions and assumed things were criminal that were not, and just manipulated the facts and the law to try to make things crimes that were not crimes.
And they did it, and people paid terrible prices for what they did. And I want to talk about that in a moment. But before we do, you mentioned non-prosecution agreement, and on page 72, I have that highlighted. What exactly is a non-prosecution agreement?
The task force threatened to indict and destroy Merrill Lynch like it did Arthur Andersen. Arthur Andersen Accounting Firm was the first Enron task force prosecution. That indictment was returned, I think, only about 3 months after the Enron task force was formed. Immediately upon release of the indictment, Andersen was put out of business. It was besieged with pile-on civil suits. It was completely destroyed, and 85,000 people worldwide lost their jobs. What most people don't realize is that the way the task force pieced together that indictment, what they charged Andersen with doing was not a crime. They charged them with witness tampering. The public thinks Andersen was indicted and prosecuted for shredding evidence. Well, as best I could tell from the entire record, Andersen kept a copy of everything in one form or another. It tried to introduce into evidence the millions, probably, of documents that it had retained. There was no law or standard that required it to keep any of the documents that it shredded at the time. It was cleaning up work papers. And even though Andersen was, I think, extremely lax in allowing Enron to pursue its overly aggressive accounting policies, what it was indicted for doing was not a crime. It took about 3 years for the United States Supreme Court to reverse the Andersen conviction and indictment 9-0. So all of that happened for no good reason at all. It was another task force disaster, and the person primarily responsible for the Andersen indictment is now the head of the criminal division for the United States Department of Justice. I wrote an article in The Observer on that called War on Wall Street, Arthur Andersen Annihilator Takes Control of World's Largest Criminal Conviction Machine.
And that's Leslie Caldwell, is that who it is?
Yes, that's exactly right. Caldwell and Weissman were the two primary prosecutors that destroyed Arthur Andersen for nothing.
For nothing, because they could.
Right.
The
and then that made everybody else crater as soon as they knocked on the door. So once Andersen was destroyed, as soon as the task force knocks on the door of Merrill Lynch can't afford to be put out of business. So they agree basically to whatever the task force wants them to agree to, including a provision that no Merrill employee could publicly speak contrary to the Enron task force view of the facts of the case. And no Merrill employee could speak with any defendant without a task force lawyer being present. And they also put any number of people listed as unindicted co-conspirators which meant that they had to get lawyers and protect themselves. They couldn't testify or talk to any of us, so no one would. For example, the Merrill defendants couldn't even find out from their own corporate counsel what happened with the transaction when they turned it over to her and how she handled it either before, during, or after their minimal involvement in it. Turned out, with the evidence we found later, it was all handled perfectly lawfully, but we didn't have that evidence available to us at the time because she wouldn't talk, and the task force didn't give us the Brady material we were entitled to. They had hundreds of pages of her grand jury testimony, her SEC testimony, and her bankruptcy examiner testimony, I believe, or maybe it was just SEC and grand jury for her, and a number of other statements that totally exonerated the Merrill defendants, and they hid it from us.
It's just criminal because they know that they are not. Obviously, they know that nothing's going to happen to them and they're going to get promoted. let's violate the Constitution. Let's violate all ethics and the Supreme Court rulings. Hey, we're going to get promoted anyway. It doesn't matter because people don't know any better. Like you said, and I was guilty of it too. We all thought, pretty much everybody thought that Enron was guilty, right? They were the bad guys.
Yeah, I did. Right? Yep,
exactly.
I did. And there certainly were some there, but... You know, nobody should have been prosecuted the way these prosecutors conducted anything.
Scary. Now, I was going to ask you about that. I'm glad you brought it up. On page 306, you talk about the naming of 100 people as unindicted co-conspirators. What exactly does that mean, an unindicted co-conspirator?
That means that from the task force perspective, they were viewed as having been in the criminal conspiracy. So they could have been indicted at any time. They were on the short list of possible criminal defendants. Many of them were hauled in front of the grand jury and scared half to death. They were all told they were, at the moment at least, unindicted co-conspirators, but that could change at any time. For example, after our Merrill in-house counsel testified in front of the grand jury, and as it turned out later, we learned gave exculpatory evidence to the grand jury that should have exonerated the Merrill defendants. After she did that, the task force was very unhappy with her, and they changed her status from witness to subject or target of the grand jury investigation, threatening her with indictment. In fact, she didn't know she wasn't going to be indicted until she heard the closing arguments in the Merrill case when the prosecutors claimed that the defendants lied to their lawyers. And the only reason they were able to claim that the Merrill defendants lied to their lawyers was because they'd hidden the exculpatory evidence by our lawyer.
Wow. And then on page 134, you talk about these two brave witnesses who testified that the task force had threatened to indict them if they testified for the defense. And then you say, as was their typical tactic of intimidation, the prosecutors telephoned them three times the night before this one person was to testify to remind him that he was a target. What kind of tactics? These are the tactics of like a bully or a mobster.
They were bullies. Yes.
This isn't our government.
Star chamber.
Right, exactly.
Right.
I mean, these aren't people that or organizations that we should look up to. I mean, it used to be that most Americans looked up to their government, right? I mean, but now it seems like it deteriorated down to the point where something's got to change.
It does. These were just egregious police state tactics.
It's scaring the heck out of me, to tell you the truth. It did scare the heck out of me. And as I said before, and I can't emphasize it enough, listeners, get the book, take the time. It's a fast read. It's, I think, 416 pages or 417 pages, which is a big book, relatively. But I can tell you that it's absolutely worth it to read it, to find out what happened. Now, you mentioned, Sydney, here about the jail time. And this is another part of the book that really disturbed me, where on page 70, where you're talking about the former Enron treasurer, Ben Glisson. Did I say his name right, Sydney? Glisson?
Yes.
Okay. When he reported to prison, the government put him straight into solitary confinement. The hole, a bug-infested cage, barely big enough to stand in, with only a slit for light. What did he do to deserve this, Sydney?
He refused to cooperate with the task force. He knew he had done something wrong. He had gotten sucked in by Fast Al. He was a young man. Way too young to be treasurer of Enron, but he had kind of gotten charmed into trusting Andrew Fast Al. And so he had done a sort of a side deal with Fast Al, pursuant to which he made $1 million. And with that, Fast Al got his tentacles into him And Glisson, having known he did something wrong, decided he would be one of the first people to plead guilty. So he pled guilty, I think, to a five-year offense. I don't remember what he actually pled guilty to. But he was going to just take his lumps and go to prison, but he didn't want to say anything about anybody else. You know, he wasn't sure what other people had actually done, and so he pled guilty but refused to, quote, cooperate with the task force. And cooperating with the task force meant you sing from their song sheet. You tell them what they want to hear. I mean, Leslie Caldwell would literally walk into her room and say, okay, listen, buddy, you know, I want to hear this, this, and this, and if you don't tell me this, this, and this, you're going to get indicted. So Glisson refused to say this, this, and this. So they took this young 30-something-year-old man when he reported to prison, which should have been to a very low security. Actually, it probably should have been to a prison camp because he was certainly no danger to anybody. And the levels of our prison system are such that the more dangerous people are put in the more restrictive security levels. Well, instead of sending him to a camp, they sent him to a much higher security level prison. And not only that, but they put him straight into solitary confinement to soften him up.
You say here on page 87 that supposedly only the Bureau of Prisons controls where a prisoner ultimately goes and how he is treated, but it was painfully clear from Glisson's treatment that these high-ranking prosecutors had considerable influence. So what you suspect is that even though the Bureau of Prisons might look at this fella and say, okay, he did this and this, it's not a violent crime, he stole some money, well, we're going to put him here, there's no reason to put him in solitary, but the only reason they softened him up was because a prosecutor might have a connection with the BOP and, hey, do me a favor, let's beat the crap out of this guy for a while.
Yeah, I have no doubt whatsoever that, no personal doubt whatsoever, that the task force directed the way these people would be treated. Our youngest Merrill defendant, 32-year-old young man, was put in a maximum security federal transfer facility hundreds of miles from his 2-year-old and 4-year-old at the time. We got him acquitted. Seth Waxman actually got him acquitted on appeal.
Mm-hmm. On page 144, that's Fuse, served 156 days in prison in that, as you described it, a hellhole in Oklahoma. And he was not guilty of any wrongdoing.
Right. Should never have been indicted. Actually, all the Merrill defendants should never have been indicted, but the Fifth Circuit actually held that Fuse never should have been indicted.
On page 145, the next page, you say they lived in daily fear of being attacked by the guards as much as by the inmate population. Now, I guess these fellas told you about this then.
Yes.
But why would the guards want to attack them?
Well, my client in particular was treated badly by the guards because I was relentless in pursuing his constitutional right to be allowed to speak with his attorney, and he definitely paid a price for that.
You're talking about Brown.
Yeah, I knew the prison folks hated my guts. He told me that. And they were rough on him on the inside because of it.
Okay, I got you. And then you mentioned this on page 151, and I was shocked by this as well. You said, I had always believed that an attorney could speak with the client virtually any time. That proved false. They gave you such a hard time. And again, listeners, you'll be able to read all about this, but they gave you such a hard time just to talk to your client that something you took for granted or you thought that existed in the justice system never really did.
That's correct. I would have to send, I don't know how many faxes, and basically threaten to contact the Fifth Circuit with a complaint that I was being denied access to my client to even get a phone call. He was never allowed to speak to me without somebody listening.
Wow. And then on page 158, where you talk about what the warden did to his cell, I felt so sorry for this guy, what he went through. And it really, if it wasn't for your dogged determination to do what was right for all of your clients, it seems. Like I said, that's why I say I feel like I know you. I have so much respect for you. I think that a person's character comes through in their writings. And these guys are lucky, really lucky, that they had somebody like you behind them.
Well, thank you very much.
That's the case, so. Thank you for doing what you do, for doing what you have done and continue to do, because obviously this country needs more people like you for the obvious reasons. We could spend hours and hours on this book, but one thing I thought was ironic was on page 188, where you talk about the public integrity section. Of course, its acronym is PIN, but it should be PISS, right?
Probably.
Yeah, they probably knew that. The Department of Justice, it's in the news, of course, Holder's in the news, and of course, he said he was going to step down, and I'm sure it had to do with the U.S. District Court, D.C. ruling that he has to, the department has to produce this information on this Fast and Furious matter. I don't know if you're following that.
Yeah, in fact, I wrote an article about it for the New York Observer at observer.com. I think it's entitled Eric Holder Runs from a Ticking Time Bomb. But I think there's even more to it than that. I wrote about the IRS case and the Fast and Furious document production that's required, or at least production of an index of all the documents that's required by October 17th, I think it is, or October 22nd. But I think there's something more to it than that. Having seen Obama and Holder's faces at that press conference, something really bad is out there, and we don't know what that is yet.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I guess that's why Holder's leaving now, because rather than face the justice system, because the justice system is saying, look, you have to produce this stuff, and he's going to be gone before. Well, let me ask you this. If he resigns, will they still have to produce this material?
Oh, yes. Yes, they definitely still have to produce it. They're under court orders by Judge Sullivan and by Judge Bates and the D.C. courts.
That's right. You say here on page 210 about the DOJ that every experienced criminal defense attorney also knew that the DOJ would never do the same kind of investigation or reach the same conclusion as would a truly independent prosecutor. Of course, you were talking about Stevens, that poor fella. The department was way too political, incestuous, self-serving, and self-institutionalized to do so. That doesn't give me as a citizen, and I'm sure it doesn't give the listeners as citizens and potential targets of the DOJ, much confidence in what we have here, right?
Right. Very unfortunate.
Can it be cleaned
up? I really think that's the way it is. Yeah, it could be cleaned up. I think the right attorney general could go in there and clean house. But it would take somebody who cared more about the rule of law than about politics.
Yeah.
Which means it would take a president who cares about the rule of law also to appoint an attorney general and stand behind somebody that was willing to clean it up.
And what are the odds of that happening?
I don't know. I'm hoping they're good because I'm not ready to give up on our country yet.
Yeah. What about SB 2197?
Is that the Fairness and Disclosure of Evidence Act? I think it is.
Yes, that's right.
Yes, that bill was proposed in response to the report of the special prosecutor who Judge Emmett Sullivan in D.C. asked to investigate the Department of Justice itself in the wake of the corrupted prosecution of Alaska Senator Ted Stevens. So in a coordinated effort, the report was made public on March 15, 2012, at the same time the Fairness and Disclosure of Evidence Act was introduced in Congress by a bipartisan group of six United States senators. It was supported by a letter signed by over 200 former Department of Justice officials, U.S. attorneys, assistant U.S. attorneys, including me, from all over the country, urging Congress to pass that legislation. It would have made Brady not just a constitutional obligation, but a law with enforcement vehicles and penalties for prosecutors who failed to comply with it that judges could impose, making it upfront and well known to everybody that there were time requirements in it and also penalties. It was also supported by the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Chamber of Commerce, the American Bar Association, state bar associations, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. As far as I know, every bipartisan major organization and entity across the country supported the passage of that legislation. It was opposed, to my knowledge, only by two entities. Are now ironically named Department of Justice, and I have learned since I started this, there is a National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, and they found it against their interests that this bill be proposed. My response to that is, Assistant U.S. Attorneys have no interest, or should have no interest. Their only interest should be in seeking justice. I was appalled to even learn there's a National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys. I don't get it. They shouldn't have any particular agenda.
It's their trade organization.
Apparently.
Yeah. Now, besides Judge Kaczynski, do you know of any judges who have read this wonderful book?
Yes, there are other judges who have read the book. I actually spoke to the Ninth Circuit Judicial Conference, which consisted of the judges of the 10 most Western states. And a number of them were very interested in my remarks and in the book. And there are other judges across the country that have read it also. I also blog at seeking-justice.org, and I know some judges have picked up on my blog post too.
That's great. How about media coverage? Because you do mention a couple of times here, which is typical of this mainstream media that we've unfortunately got in this country. They're so pathetic. They're so corrupt. On page 10, you talk about how the story faded quickly. And on page 31, the media seemed astonishingly unconcerned with that suicide. How about our mainstream media? What has their reception been toward your book?
The major networks have refused to do anything with it. I know they have all had it. The New York Times has refused any number of offers by noted reviewers to do a review of it. The New York Post hasn't done anything on it. They were going to publish something. In fact, I had seen something about what they might do, and all of a sudden, after they were going to reach out to the Department of Justice, that disappeared. They decided they weren't going to publish anything about it. So it's basically up to the radio stations. Newsmax TV has been very supportive. It still remains to be seen if any of the other news stations will do anything about it. The Washington Post and the Washington Times, the Washington Times did an editorial on it, I believe. U.S. News and World Report, there was a nice piece in that on the book. And I've got a media page at licensedtolie.com that includes a lot of TV clips, different reviews, and tweets also. Gotten a lot of Twitter hits and Facebook posts from my articles at The Observer, and all of those linked to the book because so many people named in the book are in the news today. For example, Judge Emmett Sullivan, who's very prominent as one of the heroes in License to Lie, has the IRS email case brought by Judicial Watch in front of him. He appointed a special prosecutor in the Stevens case, and he could appoint one on the IRS matter too if they don't get their act together.
What a guy. Amazing.
Yeah. And the difference between the way he handled things and the way Judge Werlein handled things is pretty dramatic.
Oh, yeah. And again, listeners, when you read this, you'll know exactly what Sydney's talking about. Now, you said you're not going to give up on the United States, and thank goodness you're not going to. But have you lost hope in the justice system?
I wouldn't say I've lost hope, but I'm definitely struggling with a big case of heartbreak.
Yeah. Are you going to keep your law license, you think?
Yeah, I'm going to keep my law license. I'm not sure how I'm going to go about using it. I've got an oral argument coming up in the Fifth Circuit in a case the end of October. And ironically enough, instead of being in New Orleans where I usually go, they've set it in Houston. And the Fifth Circuit courtroom in Houston is the one used by Judge Ewing Werlein.
Oh, God.
So I will be back in that particular courtroom to argue this case, which certainly should inspire a lively oral argument.
Oh, boy. I really can't say enough about you, Sydney, and I've never met you. You've never met me, but your book, I found myself saying to myself when I'm reading it and to others, I was bragging about the book, I love Sydney. I love her. I just love this person for what she's done. The truth that was brought to me, the knowledge that I gained from reading the book. Thanks so much, Sydney, for writing this. And I know I've thanked you over and over again during this one-hour interview, but really, I can't thank you enough for what you did. You put your, I'm not going to say your life on the line, but you put your career on the line, pretty much. Did you think about that when you were writing the book sometimes?
Yes, I did. I definitely did because, I just knew I couldn't really tell anybody about it before I wrote it. I knew I had to take full responsibility for it. I mean, I love the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals and some of the judges that I had to say things about in the book. I love those men. They're good people. They want to do the right thing. And why this one got as off track as it got is beyond my comprehension. But, I mean, one of my favorite people in the world is not speaking to me now because I wrote this book. And that's hard. But as I told somebody, one person refused to review it because I'd said things about some of his friends. And I said, I'm sorry, but they're my friends too. We have to hold each other accountable when we don't do the right thing. We have to be willing to look at ourselves in the mirror. I've tried to do that every day of my life to make sure I stay on the right path. We have to do that with our friends and our family and people we care about. I mean, from my perspective, it's a sign about how much I care about the court and the system and justice in general that I wrote the book. I did not mean to hurt anyone, but we've got to start speaking and dealing with the truth. You can't solve a problem until you correctly and honestly identify what it is.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Dave. I'm really honored that you spent this time and took the care you obviously did to read the book. This kind of response from you and the appreciation you've expressed was one of the things that has kept me going in this. Like I said, I had no idea what to expect at all, whether anybody would pay any attention, how it would be received, or anything else, but that part has been extremely rewarding.
I appreciate that. Again, thanks so much, Sydney, for writing this magnificent book, License to Lie, Exposing Corruption in the Department of Justice or Injustice, however you want to call it, by Sydney Powell. And hopefully we'll talk again real soon, Sydney.
That'd be great, Dave. Thanks again.